It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what makes a good life? What makes life worth living? We'll ask our guest and you in about 15 minutes.
First, in the big picture of energy consumption in Wisconsin, solar power may not seem to be replacing traditional finite sources of energy. Solar ranks well under 1% of energy consumption in the state.
But utility companies are taking the technology into account when it comes to the bottom line. The price to install solar panels is coming down, could be poised to grow in order to keep profits up, even as some companies and consumers get more of their power off the grid. Companies are looking to raise, in some cases, fixed monthly prices they collect from consumers.
Utility companies and supporters of renewable energy are now sometimes at odds, and We Energy stopped its renewable energy development program in 2011. Here to talk to us about this tension and why your monthly energy fee might be going up is Thomas Content. He covers energy and utilities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, so far it seemed like solar panels and other renewable energy sources are just a blip on the screen when it comes to energy use. But utility companies, they seem to be taking notice these days. What's changing?
Well, it's true. Wisconsin is getting more of its power from renewables overall, but it's largely from wind farms and hydro and not so much solar. And in fact, just recently we were celebrating the fact that Wisconsin hit its milestone for renewable energy of 10% last year, which was 2 years ahead of a deadline set out by the legislature. But solar is a different story. The solar is much smaller. It's less than 1%. But around the country, it's growing so fast, it's expected to double in just a few years nationally. And utilities are seeing a threat from the fact that the costs are coming down and basically that the customers are the ones generating the power.
Is that what's driving the growth, basically that the costs are coming down and now people can afford to install, say, a solar panel?
The costs are coming down, number one, and number two, in a lot of states where they're seeing a fast growth. There are policies in place that basically let the homeowner or the business rent the panels instead of own them. So a third-party company is coming in and installing them and owning them, and that way the homeowner or the business that wants to add solar doesn't have to pay the higher upfront costs for solar.
And that's something that's a bit controversial, isn't it, this leasing of panels? If you don't have to invest in the panels, suddenly it becomes even easier to put them up on your house.
That's right, and the renewable energy advocates would like to see that kind of policy be allowed by the state legislature. And there has been a bill at least circulated and it hasn't gone far. The status quo has been tough on solar folks who already have solar because the utilities are looking at their costs and seeing what could be ahead with distributed generation like this. And they're saying we need to recover our fixed costs, which is the cost of supplying the poles and the wires and everything to folks' homes, including those with solar.
So they're talking about raising these fixed costs, not just for those who are using things like solar panels, but for everybody.
Right, and from the utility perspective, they say, well, this is something that is more accurate because the cost of the energy, which is most of our monthly electric bill, is currently paying for things beyond just the energy itself. But the consumer groups and others that are concerned about these proposals say that jumps in the fixed charges can really have an impact on folks who don't use much energy. So if you're a small user, a small electricity user, this is going to hit you really hard if you do have higher fixed charges. And the other thing that some of the consumer groups are saying is that it discourages conservation. You know, if you take steps to change out your light bulbs and add insulation, and then you see a higher fixed charge. That may offset some of the gains you're going to see.
Right. So a lot of people going into it because they want a more renewable, cleaner source of energy, but they're also excited about lower bills. And if they're not seeing that, it sounds like you're saying maybe people will just say, well, I'll just stick with what I got.
Right. And it's going to be pretty controversial. The proposals that have come in just in the last month or so have been such significant increases in the fixed charges. The Madison utility was looking at possibly quintupling the fixed charge, the non-energy charges, I should say, and that brought in groups like Wind on the Wires and the Natural Resources Defense Council and others to really take a close look at this as this case goes to the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. Just Friday, the MG&E, the Madison utility, backed off somewhat and agreed to hold off on some of its fixed charge proposals for a year, but got an assurance from at least one customer group that the fixed charge could still go up in 2015.
Are regulators, do you think, going to allow these price increases, these fixed rate increases?
They did in the last round of cases at the Public Service Commission. There were some increases. We Energies, for instance, was allowed to increase its fixed charge by 20% after proposing to do a 40% increase. It's hard to say. I think that the wild card here is the fact that, or one of the wild cards, I should say, is the fact that the utility regulators are also being asked, to implement the EPA climate change proposal, which is going to do exactly what the customers, a lot of these distributed generation customers want, which is add more clean energy. So in other words, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions as a state, the state agencies, including the Public Service Commission, are going to be trying to look at ways to increase energy efficiency and solar energy.
So looking at the movement toward green energy, is it possible that these fixed rate raises could seemingly down the road drive people off the grid altogether, and so that in the long game, maybe raising these rates isn't going to help energy companies?
Yeah, that's a concern. I mean, it seems far-fetched, but it's definitely a concern. It may be a concern in states that have even bigger solar generation in the Southwest right now, but down the road, some analysts, including one at the Energy Center of Wisconsin, just wrote a long piece on this in a law journal that looked at that very thing. They said that just raising the fixed charges is kind of a circle-the-wagons approach, and utilities and, for that matter, utility regulators need to really have some out-of-the-box thinking. They actually made a comparison to the streetcar industry early in the last century, where there were regulated streetcar monopolies that went away, that all of a sudden faced competition from cars and trucks. And their warning is the same thing here. It's the utilities and their regulators are going to need to be creative in how they respond to this.
Now, utility companies here in Wisconsin and elsewhere had previously been offering incentives for people and companies to pursue green energy. What's the state of that right now?
Well, they offered the incentives, and it was up to a certain level. In other words, there was a cap on how many projects would be permitted. So we saw in the Milwaukee area, we saw a lot of churches and nonprofit groups add solar, and same thing in other parts of the state. But the utilities, their perspective is, well, we've invested billions of dollars in utility-owned renewable energy to meet the state's renewable energy targets. So that's largely wind farms, but also a biomass plant that burns waste wood up in north central Wisconsin. So it's the fact that in recent years they've backtracked a lot on their interest in working with groups and utility customers that want to generate their own power.
And how are environmental groups responding right now?
Some of this is just getting going. But for instance, Renew Wisconsin, which is an Madison-based renewable energy advocacy group, is duking it out in the regulatory proceedings and trying to get the third-party bill going in the legislature. But their odds have been pretty stacked against them as far as the GOP support for on energy policy has not been to embrace their proposals in the Republican-controlled legislature. And I expect that over the next year or so, both this Madison Gas and Electric proceeding and then also the We Energies proceeding at the Public Service Commission are going to generate a lot of active participation from some of the renewable groups. It may not be rise to the level of some of the solar versus utility disputes in other states where there have actually been media campaigns and television advertising, but we will see.
All right. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be with you.
We've been speaking with Thomas Content. He reports for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covering energy and utilities. We've been talking about how utility companies are responding to the growing presence of solar power on the energy market.
What makes a good life, a life well lived? Is it friends and family, helping others, achieving something, creating something, living according to the tenets of a faith, being happy, whatever that means?
And we want to hear your answer right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page, what gives meaning to your life? Dr. Richard Gunderman joins us now. He's a doctor and a philosopher and a professor at Indiana University. Dr. Gunderman, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
First, do you think it's a good thing to spend time pondering about how we answer this question? What makes a good life?
I do, in part because, as the ancient philosopher Aristotle once said, if we don't see our target, we're much less likely to hit it. So we don't have time to spend every day pondering such big questions in life. But from time to time, I think it's a good idea to step back and try to think about the direction in which our life is proceeding and if, you know, there are goals to which we'd like to devote more time and attention.
And even if we do think about these questions and maybe come up with a couple answers, how do we start to put that into practice in our daily lives?
I think one way is to look closely at your schedule. Sometimes I'll ask people, you know, what's most important to you in life? And they'll say my family, you know, or writing a book I've always felt incubating inside me. But then when you look at that person's schedule, you frequently discover that there's no time set aside for that activity, or at least the amount of time and attention they're devoting to it, you know, scheduling for it, is much less than what it would require to really deliver on their goals. So one thing we can do is to make sure we're organizing our lives and allocating our time to achieve the things that are most important to us.
Right. That can be a really difficult thing. We can say, for instance, that we want to spend a lot of time with our children, and then in the day-to-day crush of life, it sort of gets lost in the shuffle and you find yourself just sort of handing them their lunches as they run out the door. Do you have any advice for how to consciously make sure that you are hitting those goals?
Yeah, well, one way, I mean, this takes some effort, but it can pay big dividends, is first to try to schedule your time so you're spending time regularly on the things that matter most to you in life. And then secondly, at the end of a day or at the end of each day for a week, try to think about how you actually spent your time, because, you know, it's one thing to have goals, but it's another thing to check to see if you're actually pursuing them effectively. So, you know, I said today I wanted to, you know, do something with my children, and then it turned out that time was eaten up by some little fires that erupted over the course of the day. It can be useful to look at how that time was spent, and, you know, maybe we can learn some lessons that we can apply tomorrow or next week to make sure we're devoting the attention to the things that we say are most important.
Before we get into the specific things that make life worth living and get to our callers at 800-642-1234, I wonder, do you think there are some universal answers that might apply to everyone when it comes to living a good life?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, there are a number of possibilities, but one that I hear over and over again, particularly as people get further along in life, say, you know, have reached the 60s or 70s, perhaps retired, have grandchildren, that they feel like they've seen much of what life is going to serve up to them. One thing that I hear repeatedly is that I wanted to make a difference. You know, with the way I raised my children or my grandchildren, with the kind of work I did, the quality of work I did in the workplace, the fact I was there for those days or those years actually made a difference for the people I served. In my case, you know, a good bit of my professional life is devoted to the care of patients. So can I say that the fact I was that patient's doctor, as opposed to one of my very well qualified colleagues, did the fact I was that patient's doctor actually make a difference for them? And that's something, you know, whether you're a doctor or lawyer or homemaker or school teacher, accountant, no matter what you do, many of us have a deep hunger to make a difference in the lives of other people.
Now, as a doctor and a philosopher, you speak a lot with people, you know, when the chips are down, when they're facing illness. And so many of us spend a lot of time trying to accumulate wealth to pay the mortgage. Do you get the sense in talking to your patients and considering these questions that wealth is something that people are happy to have put time into when their life is over?
Yeah, well, it certainly varies from person to person. I don't think there's one single answer that each human being will give to a question like that. But some people, having experienced a serious illness, either, you know, say had cancer or a serious injury themselves or cared for a loved one or a friend who had such an injury, it often changes their sense of priorities in life. You know, some of the things that we let get under our skin and, you know, kind of torture us day in and day out. Once you've looked at them from the perspective of, you know, my life may end in 6 months, they don't seem quite so worrisome anymore. And some of the things that we haven't devoted so much time and attention to after you emerge from a serious illness can sometimes seem much more worthy of attention. And, you know, an example would be spending more time with family or trying to reconcile in a relationship that's gone bad, you know, with a sibling or a child or something like that. And you would never wish serious illness on anyone, but one of the unexpected benefits for a lot of patients is a renewed and deepened perspective on the things in life they care about most.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234, asking what makes a good life, what is good in life. We've got Mark on the line in Appleton. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm scratching the dirt out from under my fingernails because I was tilling up my garden this morning. We're baking bread tomorrow afternoon. My boys and my little girl and I play together. Simplify, simplify, simplify. Get back to the basics in life. Unplug and love the people who are near you and just simplify your life.
Mark, thank you so much for that suggestion and for your experience. And it's the little things, the simple things sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. We live in such an age of technology, you know, with computers and cell phones, and we think we're connected to so many people all at once. But sometimes our attention gets so caught up in, say, you know, Twitter or email or Facebook or what have you. You may be in a lot of relationships, have a lot of friends, so to speak. But when you look at it, some of those begin to seem rather superficial, and you might pull back and say, this is great, but I really need to form deeper connections with a very few people in my life, like Mark said, with his own children and family, the people we live with day in and day out. We don't want to let those core relationships suffer or take a false sense of satisfaction in the fact we've got so many Facebook friends when we're not spending quality time around the dinner table or working in the family garden with our own kids.
And do you think the answer to this question is something that changes as we age, as we maybe get a little more wise?
Yeah, there are prodigies in things like mathematics or music or chess, you know, kids who who are champions at the age of 10 or 12 or 14. But I sometimes think that this is an area in life where there's really no substitute for life experience. You just need to get out there and work and live and pay attention and see what turns out to be most fulfilling to you. And, when you can figure out what turns out to be most deeply rewarding to you, to try to organize your life at work and at home so you spend more time on those kinds of activities.
We're talking about what makes a good life with Dr. Richard Gunderman, professor of pediatrics and philosophy at Indiana University, and with you.
Call 800-642-1234. Tell us what to you makes a good life. 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with Dr. Richard Gunderman. He's a physician and a philosopher, and we're tackling a basic question: what makes a life a good one? What is a life well lived?
You can join in with your answer at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is it about accomplishing something, doing good, having loved ones, or something else? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Back to our callers now with Jeff in Verona. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Jeff in Viroqua again. Jeff Fazan, can you guys hear me out?
Okay, what did you want to bring up?
Yeah, first I want to thank everybody. This is an awesome conversation, and I totally agree with the professor. And I just want sense, and that I guess throughout life I've learned, and what I see wealth as now is it's a measure of time. It's like how many days you can move forward from, like, this set point right now if you lost everything else, like if you lost your main source of income. And then I think that brings us to the overall full circle that the sort of the answer to the universal question he was wondering, and that I feel that time is the most important thing in the world, and it goes hand in hand with health, because if you don't have one or the other, you're pretty much screwed with life. And so wealth, time, and health, I think that is sort of the universal answer, and I hope I did a good job contributing my 10 cents. And you can find me on Facebook at Jeff Lazan. I'm part of the Love Police. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So time, health, and wealth, Dr. Gunderman.
Sounds right to me. I think one way those themes connect is a mistake we can make is to suppose we're going to live forever. You know, I'll take care of that tomorrow or next year or a decade. I don't need to worry about it now. But in fact, if you look at life from a certain perspective, it's short. And we want to make the most of each day we have. There's an old phrase from the ancient Romans, carpe diem, seize the day. And if we're aware of how short life is, I think it can help us do our best to make every day count.
And, you know, I wonder about a headline I've seen recently that people regret at the end of life the things that they haven't done rather than the things that they've done. Is there a takeaway there, do you think, Dr. Gunderman?
Well, one thing we can do is try to think now about what our lives will look like as they reach the end. Like, what sorts of things would you hope somebody would say at your funeral? Or what sorts of things would you hope somebody might write in an obituary about you? And, that's kind of a morbid thought, but if we can step back at least occasionally and think about what we want our lives to have amounted to when they reach their end, that may help us do a better job of deciding how to use the time we have each day.
We're back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Eugene on the line in Viola. Eugene, hi.
Good afternoon. I think what makes a good life is staying out of debt. I took some teaching jobs over the years that I wouldn't have been able to, if I had any debt, which I didn't, I wouldn't have been able to afford to have done, and I hope I made a difference because I took those pretty much. But they were lower paying. If I'd had the debt, I wouldn't have been able to.
Eugene, thank you so much. That's interesting. So not just staying out of debt for its own sake, but for the freedom to do something, maybe do something good that you couldn't have afforded to do otherwise, Dr. Gunderman.
Yeah, that's right. On the one hand, many of us would say we don't want to devote every waking minute of the day to making as much money as we possibly can. But on the other hand, I don't think that gives us license to ignore money. And if you're in dire straits, financially speaking, you know, big debts or having trouble feeding yourself or your family, it's a little difficult to focus on some of the other things that make life worthwhile. So to say on the one hand that we don't want to make finances or money our top priority is not to say they don't matter at all. And sometimes if we look at life carefully, we realize that there are some things that cost money we can do without, and you know, not have to incur those kind of financial worries, say buying a house bigger than we can afford, or you know, making some risky investments that could turn out to haunt us down the road.
And we're going to go back to our callers now and take Tiana next in Tomahawk. Hi there, Tiana.
The purpose of living life is to live a godly life and telling others about Jesus. And I went to Haiti on a missions trip and told everyone in Haiti about that. And I think that's the purpose of life, is to tell others about Christ.
Okay, thank you so much for your call. And Tiana, expressing the role of faith in a life, a lot of people would answer something like that, regardless of what that faith is. What about that answer, Dr. Gunderman?
Yeah, I think Tiana's right on target there. For many people, one of the most important features of a life well-lived is that you've devoted your life to some transcendent purpose. Obviously, different faith traditions would give different accounts of that, but you feel like you're serving some purpose beyond yourself, and, you know, maybe some purpose that's going to persist even beyond your own life. When you have an experience like that, where you feel that you've made a difference that goes beyond the significance of your own life, I think Tiana's absolutely right. Share that with somebody. In fact, make it a habit to share with people your peak experiences. For one thing, it'll get them thinking about their peak experiences, and for another, it leads to some really terrific conversations. I find that one way you can best understand your own sense of purpose in life is to share it with other people, because as you hear yourself talk and hear the questions they pose and how they react, you often get an even clearer sense of what you're really working and living toward.
Tiana, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Tom with us in Sheboygan. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I got a question concerning your great program here. Dale Carnegie's book, in his great book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, he says about life, what do you want? Not many things, but the few things that you do wish, you crave with an insistence that will not be denied. Some of the things most people want include health and the preservation of life, food, sleep, money and the things money will buy, life in the hereafter, sexual gratification, the well-being of our children, and a feeling of importance. And he expounds on that, a feeling of importance that we crave so much for.
A lot of basics there, Tom. Thank you for that call. But I like that last one, a feeling of importance. Maybe that fits in with what you said about a feeling of having made a difference, Dr. Gunderman.
I think that's exactly right. Deep down inside, we aspire to lead lives of significance, to know that we made a difference in at least the life of one other person. And if that's what matters most to us, that's an ability that we want to cultivate. You know, if it's going to be teaching, try to be the best teacher you can. In my case, it's going to be something like practice of medicine, try to become the best doctor you can. But try to figure out what kind of difference we hope to make in the lives of others, what the enduring significance of our lives will be, and then focus on developing those talents so you can make as big a difference as possible.
So we can hit these markers in our lives, these things that to us make a good life. We have to stop every now and then, like you said, and take stock. Can you leave us with some ideas for introspection?
I think one of the best tools of introspection is reading and conversation. I would encourage listeners who, few people are going to take me up on this, but I think one of the best things listeners can do is select a good book or two and find at least one friend or colleague who's willing to read it with you, and then talk about it. It could be a novel, it could be a work of biography, historical fiction, but a book that speaks to you or that you expect will speak to you, read that and discuss it with someone else. And frequently a good book can act as a terrific catalyst to help us focus our conversation and reflection on what we want our lives to be all about.
Dr. Gunderman, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
We've been talking to Dr. Richard Gunderman, professor of pediatrics, medical education, and philosophy at Indiana University. You can keep on sharing your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Sight is something a lot of us take for granted. Kathy Schneider has been blind since birth, but she says a lack of vision isn't really the problem she has navigating the world.
I don't think much about being blind. I just am and have been so since birth. Like most things, it has its ups and downs. I've had the privilege of working with 9 wonderful seeing eye dogs in my life. But on the other hand, there's a bubble of isolation that surrounds those of us who have visible disabilities that is a pain. Recently, I went to a funeral of an amazing woman at my church in Eau Claire. My yellow lab guide dog and I got there and got in line to sign the condolence book. The isolation bubble began forming for me when the person standing by the book asked, in a surprised tone, if I was sure I wanted to sign the book. Maybe they were holding out a pen toward me, which I didn't see, or maybe the fact that I was digging around in my purse looking for my signature stamp threw them off. I suppressed my tendency to say something snarky and just said, yes, I do. Then the usher seated us in an empty pew and the bubble settled around me. Nobody sat in the row with us. Time passed, the church filled, and still we sat in the pew by ourselves. What were people thinking who knew me but sat elsewhere? There's Kathy and her guide dog. I could sit by them, but I don't usually, so would I have to help them or what? I'll just sit over somewhere else. One of the tough parts about being blind is I can't spot a friend to sit by unless they're talking loudly when I walk in. At parties, I usually roost somewhere and wait to see who comes up to greet me. My guide dog can nose people in greeting who smell interesting, but that isn't always a good thing, depending on where she noses. She often helps in bubble breaking because she's a kid magnet, and then parents come forward to drag the kids away. Friends with other disabilities tell me it's not just blind folks who live in the bubble of isolation. After the funeral, several people said hi, and we chatted briefly as we exited the church. Sometimes the isolation bubble is broken in amazing ways. A fall trip to a local farmer's market to pick out gourds as little gifts for friends is a good example. After having great fun pawing through all the gourds with all their interesting twists and turns, I went to pay the Hmong farmer for my choice gourds. He said, no pay. He was giving them to me. I said, no, I'll pay. He said, no again, and tapped his heart and said, gift from the heart. I have a hard time accepting charity, but this was different. Clearly, he knew the truth of Anne Frank's quote, no one has ever become poor by giving. I relished giving the gourds out and telling each recipient the story of this man who had reached through my bubble of isolation. As I trotted home from the funeral, I mulled over how it could have gone better. Should I wear a sign that says, please speak to me, I don't often bite? We are people of action in Wisconsin. Now that you've heard my story, next time you see a person with a visible disability sitting alone, you'll know how to break the isolation bubble, and I'll bet you'll do it.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Jana. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8 o'clock. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Well, Mike Walsh joins us now in the studio. He's losing his sight, and he's been traveling the world, educating people about sight issues and just seeing the world as part of his Flight for Sight campaign. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, first, what is the condition that may cause you to completely lose your vision?
Well, I have a condition. It's called Usher Syndrome Type 2, and being syndrome, that means more than one thing. So first off, I have a hearing loss, moderate to severe, and that is corrected with hearing aids. I can hear pretty well. And then the other part is retinitis pigmentosa. That is a degenerative condition where I'm slowly losing my sight. The photoreceptor cells in the retina are that detect light have been dying, and so it all starts with night vision. So everything gets darker at night. About 2 years ago now, I was stopped being able to drive altogether, and also the condition continues where your peripheral vision starts to go, and so I stopped driving because I stopped being able to make turns during the day, and so that became harder and so forth.
And if I may ask, do you know when you'll completely lose your sight, if ever?
Yeah, so there's different various conditions within the condition. Retinitis pigmentosa itself, it varies for everyone. It is rare with people who have Usher syndrome type 2 to lose their sight completely. But even no matter how bad I get, I recently attended the Visions Conference for the Foundation Fighting Blindness. I've been hearing all sorts of things about clinical trials and cool technology that will help assist me in the future, however worse it gets.
And we just heard from someone who's been blind since birth, who felt a sense of isolation when people see someone different in a way, someone with a disability. Does that worry you? Does that go through your head as you listen to that piece?
Yes, that was interesting. And if it's funny, with blind, those with vision issues, often it's not visible that they have those issues unless they have a guide dog with them or a cane. And that is, I am in that weird transition where sometimes I don't even use a cane and I'll walk around and I'll bump into things. And, you know, that's just a reminder that I should be having my cane. But the more familiar I am with a place, the less I like to use it. However, having had a disability, so to speak, my entire life, I've had hearing aids my entire life. I was diagnosed when I was about 3 that I had a hearing problem. And I've always kind of, it's always been a part of my life. And so I'm pretty secure in having a disability. You know, I use a cane and it's all good. And my brother has the same thing. So we all go through it together. It's just it's a normal part of life for me.
So when did you decide to start the Flight for Sight campaign?
Yeah, so that happened basically early January or mid-January. I had this opportunity to travel. I had this pass through Delta through a friend who's a flight attendant. And I had this certain love for social media, and so I had this pass, social media, and I love to travel. And so I just sort of smushed all three of those things together. And the idea of flight, sight, what should I call it, mic seeing. A friend of mine came up with Flight for Sight, and you should raise awareness. So I used social media. I crowdsourced where I went and what I did. And that was a way to get people involved and be like, oh, he's doing this to raise awareness for vision issues. And so I've had fun with social media and, yeah, using that.
And I want to talk some about your travels. I saw one of your highlights was Ethiopia. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Ethiopia was a really interesting, excellent experience that someone posted on my wall. It was that day that I launched it. He said, you know, we're here living in Ethiopia. You should join us. He works for the embassy, and he was telling me all these different charities he could take me to. And so one of the things I visited was the School for the Blind in Ethiopia, where all the children from all over the country that have vision issues, and most of them can't see very much at all, came to the school, and I was able to go there and learn about their needs. Some of the simple things that they needed were just canes, and some of them that did have canes, they had short wooden sticks, and it was interesting to see the need, and they were asking for something as simple as cassette recorders so they could record their teachers. And but yeah, Ethiopia was a very interesting experience, and thanks to my friend Dan Swift that was able to go there.
And it's amazing. You're just kind of putting the word out there in social media, and people come to you with these paths. How do you choose what path to pursue then?
Yeah, so I started off with my first post, and then I was basically like, you know, tell me a location, and the locations with the most likes is where I'm going to go. And then I also combined that with the interesting comments, you know, like Ethiopia. Oh, that sounds like a really great idea. So the most liked comment was a friend posted New Zealand, and that got about 36 likes within a couple of days. I was like, wow, I guess I'm going there. And then the timing was interesting in that people were like, it was a few days before the Super Bowl, and they were like, telling me to go there, and I was just like, okay. I attempted to go to the Super Bowl, but I wasn't able to get a ticket. Oh. But I went to New York, and so that was fun.
A lot of this sounds expensive. How do you do? Are you able to do this on the cheap, or just with people you meet up with online? How does that work?
Yeah, so like I said, the pass with Delta is a tremendous help. So that's that helps with the airlines. And then, yeah, I'm able to meet friends, and I see friends throughout the journey, and a lot of them offer me a place to stay. And a lot of people hear about this, and so they want to help. So it's an amazing experience that people just helping out. You know, humans are beautiful. And, yeah.
And San Francisco, I think, was another recent stop. You had some great experiences there.
Yeah, I did. All because of one post. One individual, a college friend of mine, posted on his wall, and he has 350,000 followers. And so that led to all these experiences, to another woman who knew I was coming out, and she was able to give me some tickets for various things, including the Facebook conference that was going on. So I had a great time and there, and I continue to learn about the Facebook platform, how I can use it better. And San Francisco, there's so much technology going on, and I'm starting to look into how technology is helping us with vision issues. It is the center of, you know, the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world, and so just being able to use that technology, press a button to have someone show up to pick you up, is just truly, truly amazing, and I'm looking forward to seeing that technology grow.
You know, we started off talking about this isolation bubble that probably a lot of people with a disability or not feel at some point. You are tapping into something maybe that we're just on the edge of out there. A lot of people have the door open to connect with people they don't know.
Yeah, social media, the internet is truly amazing. One of the things I really started to work with in the past few months is Facebook groups. They are an excellent way to make a rare disease not feel so rare. So I was able to talk to other people with the condition. I've never met anyone with Usher syndrome before besides my brother, and that's the last thing I think about when I think of my brother. So I was meeting people with Usher syndrome online and recently at the conference in Colorado, and we're able to talk about it, and we're able to grow on each other's experiences and so forth. And we learn from each other, and we talk about research that's going on and so forth. And it's really interesting.
Mike, just briefly, what's your next stop?
My next stop actually is next week. I'll be attending the family conference, Usher Syndrome Family Conference at Harvard Medical. I'll be speaking on a panel there, and it is in conjunction with the International Symposium on Usher Syndrome. It is going to be the largest Usher Syndrome gathering ever in history. The first time they're combining these two conferences, and that'll be an interesting experience next week.
Mike, thanks for joining us, and happy travels.
And thank you for having me.
That's Mike Walsh. He's the creator of the Flight for Sight campaign. You can find more info at flightforsight.co.